This is the Partnership Playbook, a podcast helping sales and marketing leaders secure high-value partnerships that finally unlock business growth and reclaim time. I'm your coach, Phil Hayes Sinclair. Welcome to the show.
All right, so today's guest knows what it takes to go global, and not just in theory. Ramsey Pryor has spent the last two decades translating bold ideas into market-leading businesses across the US, Europe, Asia, and Latin America. From launching IBM's first cloud-based email offering to turning Branch Metrics into a household name across international markets to now leading the charge at Roomy, which I'm very excited to talk to him about, as he is currently there, the CEO. So backed by Floodgate and Craft Ventures, where he's leading the way that we are going to rethink the way that meetings work in the AI era. And before this, he founded Port of Entry Partners, a boutique consultancy helping more than 10 companies crack the code on international expansion, even more important in the world that we're living in right now. This conversation is going to go deep into how go-to-market strategy actually works, the why behind building cross-cultural barriers. Actually, no, let me just start that again, mate. Sorry.
No problem.
This conversation is going to go deep into how go-to-market strategy works and the why behind building across cultures and what's next in the AI-enabled collaboration era. Welcome, Ramsey. It's great to welcome you to the show.
Thanks, Tal. Thanks for having me.
Let's start at the very beginning here, because I am super keen to understand more about what's happening in the world of collaboration, and we're doing it so much more now. Post-COVID, it feels very normal, but we were muddling our way through COVID trying to work out how to collaborate across every single border we knew. So let's start with this. What mission are you on?
The mission we're on right now is, if we're all going to spend as much time as we do in meetings, especially online meetings, the mission we're on is just giving people a lot more out of that investment. And AI is a great tool to help us accomplish that and actually spend less time in meetings, but get a lot more of the information that we need to do our jobs. So I think we can have the best of both worlds that way.
I am looking forward to understanding that in a lot more detail, because the number of hours I think many people are spending, and now across every single border that they can possibly think about, trying to take notes, understand, consume, lead, then make decisions, is just stepping up a notch every other day. In the conversations we have with the people we work with, they're usually working over at least three time zones, and they're trying to make sure that the cultures they're talking to are understanding not just the cultural undertone, but what's happening on the ground as well. And we'll talk about this. I'm a massive fan of doing things local, but when you're trying to grow, that becomes very difficult if you can't communicate well.
Indeed. That, in fact, was the impetus for why we started Roomy. Was Roomy was a pandemic baby. And like you said, not only do we spend so much of our time in meetings, it's not just meetings anymore. It's not just in our time zone anymore. So just some stats to help put a finer point on it. So on average, one third of the work week is spent in meetings. In the pandemic, it was a lot more. For me, it's quite a bit more than that, but that's the average. Two thirds of that time is spent reviewing information from other meetings. That was a Harvard Business study that came out. And 75% of what gets discussed is forgotten within one day. And those three things really is what drove us to start Roomy in the first place. And like you said, it's not just about how much time we spend or note-taking. We are working globally now. We work with people with different accents. Not everybody's on the same language level. And AI, instead of trying to make every online meeting just like an in-person meeting, I think that was a folly that we tried to do during the pandemic. But if we embrace what's actually good about online meetings, we can do things that we weren't able to do in in-person meetings, and the in-person meetings that we have can be a lot richer.
Yeah, and I think people would agree, getting back into in-person has been such a relief on so many levels. But the reality of work now is that so much more of our work is going to be done virtually. So like I said, very excited to get to Roomy and to dive into that. I'd like to just step into your background on international go-to-market for a minute. You know, across Europe, Asia, Latin America, these are massive expanses of business and cultures and time zones. What originally sparked your interest in global business?
I grew up in a multicultural family, and I didn't actually think about it at the time, but I did. And as I entered high school and college, I had some opportunities to go outside of the U.S. And for me, that experience was life-changing and mind-blowing. And ever since then, when I graduated from university, I had this vague idea that I wanted to work in international business, but practically speaking, I really had no idea what that looked like. And so what I tried to do is with every job, I just tried to find the subject matter that was interesting to me, but always choose things that would allow me to learn about a new part of the world that I hadn't been in. And over job changes and years, I just started naturally getting to know a little bit more about a new region every time. And then at a certain point in my career, my entire job description was international expansion. And for me, that was really aligning everything I'd built for quite a few years. I had to use every network connection I'd ever made, everything I knew about the markets I had spent time in, and then go as fast as I could to cover the entire globe with a product that had universal product market fit. So for me, I think the interest was always there and the curiosity, and it was just such a fascinating challenge. And I think that for a lot of software companies in particular, most of what they do, it's not sort of limited naturally by geographics or a certain market. Most things that companies are inventing are meant to be global or destined to become global. And these days, so many of the old barriers to going international are gone, that when you're starting a business today, you really have a lot more freedom and flexibility to think about where should we start and how quickly should we go into different places and in what order. And a lot of the old playbooks and best practices no longer apply.
Really pleased you said that. That was going to be one of my next questions. So whenever we hear the term go to market, those three words sort of do what they say on the tin. And many people who are thinking, who are operating in product or, for example, in other functions that have never had to walk into an entirely new market and set up the groundwork for a customer to be able to pick up the product and use it well, won't actually understand what goes into that. It's like, we're going to move into Singapore. Great. And that is just the word on the slide, but the things that go into actually making that work, not just from a regulation point of view, but from a, does this make sense? Will people understand it? Will people actually even want it? Will pricing work? How do we land? How do we try and make more than five people like it? And more so, when you get off the airport, get off the plane at the airport, where do you go and where do you start? Like all of these really fundamental things, I think people forget when they think about go to market, particularly international expansion. So just for people listening, in case they're not clear, when you define go to market in an international setting, what is the language you use to describe that when you're saying to your team, we need to enter X region? Like, how do you describe that?
It's a great question. I think the first chapter of that always should start with research. And you should not make the presumption that because you have product market fit in one market that you have global product market fit, or the next market on paper that looks attractive, you're naturally going to succeed in. Brand does not travel across border very well. Even if you're extremely well-known in one region, it's still surprising to me today how unknown some of the big brands in the U.S. are in even English-speaking markets like Australia. Mm-hmm. So brand does not travel. Usage does not necessarily travel. If you sell three things, maybe two of the three of those will do well in the second market. Maybe one of the three, maybe none of the three. So for that reason, I think step one is always, before you decide to go, there's a lot of groundwork that you should do, that you can do. It doesn't take a lot to do it. And the companies that do this the best have a system for how to, once you have a hypothesis about a market, how to go and test it without investing a lot of undue time or resource. One of the ways that we did that when I was at Branch Metrics was we would put ambassadors on the ground first, and those people would enter the community that we wanted to be part of. And they gave us incredible information and intelligence about the maturity of that, where to where do the startups hang out? Because that's who we were going after. What are they talking about? Who are the companies that we should build relationships and partnerships with so that we can enter with some credibility? And then and only then, when you really understand the dynamics, would we start putting a plan in place and feet on the ground.
It's super interesting, isn't it? That is such a... Just I want to double click on that statement around brand doesn't travel well over borders. There have been many times where I've seen senior executives land at meetings being told by the people who are supposed to be opening those markets that everything is very familiar, just to be shown that actually it's nowhere near what the familiarity needs to be. That's a super important point that we'll just highlight for all the audience. Let's go back to Rumi and talk more about what you see meetings looking like in 5 years' time. And I understand part of the journey you've been on, you described a little bit earlier, but you know, we usually are engaging with 4 or 5 different softwares when we're dealing with, you know, virtual meetings. Most of us now have a level of comfort, I hope, with something transcribing in the background and that something's sort of spat out the other side so that we can at least have a sense of what was talked about. And I think that's been a massive leap forward compared to scribbling notes madly and trying to, you know, pay attention to multiple screens and all the things that we know happen with pandemic meetings. What are you seeing the evolution that Rumi's going to lead over the next 3 to 5 years? And what does that experience, do you think, look like at that point?
I'm glad you used the term evolution. That's exactly the way that we think about it. And we see the evolution of AI-assisted meetings in 3 pretty distinct phases right now. Version 1 of this era was, hey, instead of having a human take notes, let's have the AI transcribe and take all the notes. We don't have to worry about that. We'll send a summary out afterwards. And that allows everybody to pay a lot more attention to the actual discussion. And it also allows a lot of that information to not just fall through the cracks. And at this point, there's a lot of tools that can do that. We do that as well, and we think we do a pretty good job of it. But that was kind of the initial foray. And that's frankly where we think the state of technology and usage mostly is today. Version 2 of that that we released last year that we're really excited about is what we call meeting memory. And so rather than just having your notes taken care of and a summary sent out, we believe that, you know, if we're going to spend 30%+ of our day in meetings, at the end of a year, just my meetings alone is a stack of paper 10 feet tall. That's a lot of data. Multiply that by all of your employees. There's a lot of value and things in there but that you would never have written down in a summary. And if you have that much data to go back to and ask with the power of an LLM, hey, what were we talking about 6 months ago? Why did we make this decision? You know, even something as simple as like, hey, I met with Phil 3 months ago. He mentioned something about this thing. Can you remind me what he said exactly?
Yeah, clever.
That is version 2, and that's meeting memory. And it's not just your own meeting data, but when an entire company who's using a note-taking tool pools all of those transcripts and that knowledge in one place that anyone can tap into, that is really transformative. And that's what we've built with meeting memory. So that's the second phase. And then the third phase that we are just releasing now is the proactive version of that. So rather than being able to go and fetch information that you think, oh, I know I had this conversation, let me go back to that moment in time. Like you said, conversations are happening 24/7 all around the world. And it's not just meetings, chats happening in Slack. There's discussions happening at every productivity tool you use. You could spend your entire day just staying on top of what's been said, and it's just not possible. So what we see the next evolution of this that we're working on is I need to just tell the platform who I am and what I care about, what I want to be aware of. And then anytime there's new information that got discussed in a meeting that I didn't even know existed or was discussed in a Slack channel in the middle of the night, and I may or may not have seen it, and all the updates that happened in Notion and in my CRM, just tell me what happened, because I don't want to spend the first hour or 2 hours of every day reading a million channels, clicking a bunch of red dots until they're all not red anymore, and so forth. So that's what we call X-ray. X-ray because we're scanning through this pile of data and just telling you the bits that you want to know. And that's all possible now that meetings and discussions are being recorded, transcribed, put into a centralized place, and now putting the power of AI on top of that.
So I'm so relieved to hear some of those things. And let me explain why. When we, in my last business, we were scaling pretty hard in biotech during COVID, and we were helping with diagnostics, which was a big deal at the time. And the number one complaint from our team, which was obviously distributed, but we had a good chunk of our team operating in labs to do our scientific work, was that they can't take computers into the lab. And so when they're there 7 or 8 hours a day and a lot is happening in product or technology or whatever the case is, so much would happen. And then there would be things happening overnight. And the point of overwhelm wasn't the volume of work. The point of overwhelm, sorry about this. The point of overwhelm was that they just couldn't keep up. And so when they come back into Slack the next day, the point of, so what has happened and what decision did I miss and what is it now I've got to make decisions on now? And so between a third and half of the day was actually just trying to recover context for those conversations, which was breaking our team. And the thing as a leader, as you well know, is how do I keep my team across everything so that we can stay on track and so that I don't need to be in every room to make every decision sort of stick together. This is super exciting, Ramsey. I think this is going to be something for teams that I don't think they fully realize yet. I still have scar tissue from Slack from that time. And when people say to me, I'll just join the Slack channel, I have this visceral reaction that I've got to try and hold back because of just having to try and consume so much content in that sort of scrolling style format that it's difficult to stay across.
You have to have help these days to stay on top of all this information. We simply don't have the bandwidth or capacity. There'll be no time to do real work if not.
That's it. So one thing about your history, which I think is quite fascinating, is you've obviously been a CEO. We call ourselves operators, doing the work to build companies. You've also been an advisor, and you've done this a couple of times. So what has that experience of going between advisor and CEO taught you about the blind spots of building something like this? Because people often look in at founders, CEOs, entrepreneurs, and look at the glory, at least perceived, of that being able to build things, raising capital, keeping teams together and growing. What has that past experience taught you about doing this now? Because I think some of the best founders in the world are the ones that have had some lived experience to have context for how to relate to others, how to bring cultures together, and how to bring often a pretty disparate group of people together on a ride, which can be anything but certain. So what's that experience been like for you?
Thanks for asking. When I started Port of Entry Partners, I had just spent five of the most intense years of my life trying to build up a business around the globe. And you're so heads down working in the business that you don't have a lot of bandwidth to work on the business. But after that, I felt like I had learned something, so many things that were not in a book, not in a podcast, not in anything, that were only learned through experience and from talking to other people who would help market by market, help me understand what the dynamics are and what we don't know and how to approach it. So when I was done with that experience, I felt like I was the beneficiary of so many people who had given me this information that I couldn't find anywhere. Yeah. And so that was why I started Port of Entry Partners, because I felt like every company who does this, and so many companies do, are going to make the exact same mistakes that we made. And everyone follows the same logic. It's mistakes that are understandable, but very preventable. And you can kind of only learn some of those things through making the mistakes. So being able to going from being in the seat and operating and doing it to taking some time just to think about everything I had learned and synthesized, and then being able to help companies accelerate or avoid mistakes or go faster or go more efficiently was super gratifying. And I guess some of the learnings from that were, number one, as a startup and as a business, I wondered at the beginning whether I could scale that type of business or not, and whether I could put everything I'd learned as some sort of a playbook that I could then scale. And I think what I found out after working with over 10 pretty big companies was, no, there is zero playbook that makes sense going from one business to the next. And every client that I worked with, there was a lot of knowledge that I could bring, but there was a lot of tailoring it to what is your actual business? Who's your customer? What is the market like for what you do in every new place? And so I felt like it was, that was a learning, and I didn't really intend for that consulting practice to be kind of a scaled up consulting firm. But when, after helping a bunch of other companies and then being back in this position of growing a company from the beginning and a global company, I got to kind of go from practice to theory and now back to practice with the benefit of what I had learned. And now a couple of, you know, a dozen plus other companies that I had seen inside their journey as well. And also now the world and the dynamics have changed once again. So maybe some of the things that we would have done 2 or 3 years ago no longer apply as well. But yeah, I think going back and forth is really gratifying. It helps you. I think it's very hard for companies to take a step back when they're in the middle of expansion and see the bigger picture. And that's what I could offer. And having done that now, maybe in this role, I'm able to zoom in and zoom out a little bit more than I would have been able to, knowing that the benefits of taking a step back every once in a while.
You know, it's interesting. We often, when we were in college or in business school, there were often very staid theories, textbooks, voices in management that people will still quote today and say, you know, the Druckers of the world and the like, where it was all of these things are almost business management royalty. And the issue in much of that right now is, as you've said, the world has shifted sort of twofold. One, through COVID, where we had to realize just things weren't as, you know, bedded down as we once thought. And then moving into the AI revolution, there is a lot shifting again. Now, humans have this innate ability to factor 2 to 1 things going poorly compared to things going well. And I think it's fair to say that we would often believe that things are usually not as bad as they are, and they're certainly not as good as they are either. So there's a human inertia piece to all of this. But my question to you is, you know, when we think about go-to-market and the mistakes you saw other companies make, in the spirit of teaching currency on a show like this, what are some of the things that you have always front of mind in terms of mistakes that people make in go-to-market that you would, without knowing the context of a business, say to them, listen, if I only had 10 minutes with you, just keep these few things in mind? What would you say those things are for go-to-market international expansion-wise?
I would say, number one, product market fit is not universal. So know that. Know that if you're killing it in your home market, that does not mean that your product, your brand, your value prop is going to travel, which means, number two, you need to do a lot more research than you might expect before you choose your next market, before you hire. One of the most common things that I see in every direction, U.S. companies going into Europe or Asia, Asia or European companies coming into Europe or into North America, everybody starts by trying to hire a sales leader. It's so common. And it's like, we've got this product now, we just need to go put a sales team everywhere. Rarely, I would say, does that work unless it's just sort of the product market fit is off the charts. Typically, that's not the best first hire. And there's, like I was saying earlier, I think there's ways that you can start smaller. You can start with consultants. You can start with partners. You can start with contractors. You can start by flying in and going into an adjacent market before you actually start hiring for it. And it's really important in those early stages for the founders or CEO to spend actual time themselves in that market, rather than just relying on the local team to be the voice of truth and all the eyes and ears that they have. So those are the main things. Those are the main things that come to mind.
It's funny, when we were looking at moving into Singapore, for example, as a regulatory step in biotech into the rest of Asia, the number of times that I would fly from Sydney to Singapore and spend time on the ground, you know, weeks at a time to learn what was going on. I really don't think there was ever a chance of me understanding that from reports or from a, in inverted commas, on the ground partner that you would hire, because the incentives are so different until you get there yourself to see what's going on and ask the questions you need. And the intuition that you need also to understand, there are some things that go from human to human, you know, the looks on people's faces, the comprehension they have, the way in which they're going to engage contractually, that can't be known until you're sitting face to face with them and spending some quality time with them to help them understand what your vision is. Because no matter how well you can define your vision and what you think your product is doing on paper, it will always take explanation, right?
There will always be partners that want to take your money and your business and help you enter. If you're relying on them to give you an accurate picture of what's going on, that's, you're very vulnerable. You won't know who to trust, and you really need to see it with your own eyes, like you said.
Yeah, I agree. And so when you are assessing a new partner, so as you're thinking about Rumi, for example, and I take your point around not having a salesperson as the first person on the ground, when you're thinking about putting Lumi into a new geography, how are you assessing that rollout and that investment to go from one market to the next, knowing that this is software and, you know, the theory is that it should be able to scale reasonably seamlessly from one point to the next? How do you think about making plays into new markets? What's your mental model for that?
The first thing is what looks good on paper. Then the next, after you decide what market you think will look good for you theoretically, is to go test it and see what the state of timing is. Timing is such an important factor when you're going into a new market, because there's this, whatever you're selling, there's this curve that the entire market goes through of, does anyone know about this category at all? When they start knowing about it, you may not want to be the first one that goes and spends a lot of time and money educating the entire market. It's sometimes it's best to be the second or the third person, so you can come in and people are like, oh, I understand what you do. We haven't made a decision yet. When you can find those signals, then that's the second biggest factor, is like, of the markets we're considering, which one is right now? And for Rumi, we found by starting in the US, we started closing some business in Australia. Australia is not usually the second market that I've gone into, but timing-wise, it felt perfect because there was awareness for what we did. There was need, but there was not a lot of incumbents that we had to deal with. And so even though timing aside might not have been the second market for us, because timing was seemingly so strong, then that moved up the list. And I think that's the challenge with a lot of markets, especially in Europe. They look so big. And then when you go in and you try to penetrate Germany or France or even the UK, there's so many other factors that you'll run into that will slow things down. And meanwhile, you're losing a really important market that you might have gone into next. And as a startup, it's really important, the momentum and the order that you crack the world.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. And so in your case as well, Rumi, I imagine, plays a part in an ecosystem as opposed to, I mean, it can, I'm sure, play a role as a standalone product. But when we're thinking about ecosystems, and software ecosystems have become larger and larger and probably more crowded as time has gone on. When you're thinking about how not just the geographic market, but then I guess the software market, the ecosystem that you would go and play into, that's a different game altogether. So to what extent does moving into an ecosystem help you then land into a new market, like Australia, for example, where there might be a technology partner that you can perhaps piggyback off the back of to come into a market? How do you think about that?
Rumi is a great example. So what we do ties in is so inherently tied to the meeting platform, the calendars that people use, the other tools that are in use, that where information lives. Australia is very different from other markets in terms of those things. It's a very heavy Microsoft market. Google's made very little penetration, same with Zoom, relative to other markets. So you have to know that coming in, and startups have limited time and resource. So if we were not strong in that ecosystem, we would have to wait. If we had spent all of our time really dialing things in for a Google ecosystem, then that would impact how aggressively we would go in. But that was definitely an eye-opener for us. We had a heads up coming in, but also the other tools that people use for productivity are quite a bit different in Australia. There's big presence of companies like Atlassian. Project management, workflow tools also have a different skew over there. So knowing the ecosystem you're going into and the preferences and where the relationships are, who's already working together, you have to take that into consideration and decide whether that's going to be something you can penetrate or not.
Yeah, I find it interesting where there is almost a, when people are thinking, software CEOs in particular, are thinking about, well, we could do a deal with Microsoft, or we could do a deal for the Google ecosystem, or, you know, even doing a deal with Atlassian. I think many companies have done a great job. You know, those stalwart companies have done a great job to integrate easily. But that doesn't mean that there is a partnership there waiting to be had in order to help you enter the market, right? The fact that you can click and integrate is one thing. It is a very different thing to be able to have their support, or to be able to be introduced into their key accounts to make it all work. So I imagine from a go-to-market, market readiness point of view, there's more than just a set of API docs that your team is looking at to make that real. And for people who aren't familiar with that, can you talk maybe a little bit around how that works on the inside? Because we all see these big brands, they're not getting any smaller. They do have, you're right, they do. Microsoft has a massive foothold in Australia. And I'm still very surprised when I receive an invite, or someone receives an invite from me, and we're usually Google shop. You know, people say, I've never used Google Meets before. And my question to you, I just said, really? That's interesting. The most fascinating conversation I think I had coming into a conversation with Apple was using a very different conferencing service that I hadn't used for 15 years. It was like, really? Okay, good. Well, if we're here, if we all made it, that's good. Let's get into the conversation. But how does that work on the inside too? Because to my point earlier, I suppose there is an ability to partner with large companies, but usually it's at a two or three tier level. It's not just let's get their logo on our deck to make it easier for us to enter that market. We're doing it at a technology level. We're doing it at a business development and client level. And then you've got your technology stack as well, trying to scale that at the same time as having these conversations. So how does that generally work across the board for you guys?
I think the nice thing, right, at least for the moment, is that there's a lot of interoperability just via APIs, just via, I think right now, because of LLMs and everybody seeing the value of getting data out of silos, it's actually easier than it used to be to interact with the ecosystem, to build for multiple integrations. That may change because increasingly we're seeing walled gardens start to be built back up because data is so valuable, and porting data around, maybe somebody does a better job of processing data from another platform than they are doing. So I think for us, our North Star here would be, what's the ecosystem and the stack that our ICP is using? Mm-hmm. And that's where we're going to focus. And that may also impact the geographies that we choose and the partnerships that we pursue and so forth. And that's one of the hardest things, especially at the beginning, for a company to know is who really is your ICP. And, you know, for us, when we closed our first 10 or 20 customers, we did what we call white glove onboarding so that we could get extremely close to those teams and understand not just how and why they're going to use us, but how does this fit into your entire workflow? And when we understood that and all the other tools they're using, then we really got a sense of, okay, this is where our sweet spot is, and these are the tools that are most important to them. And that gave us a very clear signal of the 50-some potential integrations we could focus on. It really came down to like five or six that we needed to nail.
Yeah, interesting. So just for people listening who have caught their attention has been caught by the idea that you can add this much value to their meetings now, and this the recall aspect and the summary aspect is pretty significant. How would you describe the ICP to people listening? And then I'd love to point them to the right place. If you can tell them where we can point people, that'd be great too.
Yeah, I mean, the ICP is really dispersed teams. And that could be a team within a big company. It could be a company like ours that's, we're a 20-person company that's geographically dispersed and completely remote and a smaller company. But that's the real sweet spot is note-taking, we think, should be thought of not just for yourself, but, how do you combine the power of everybody's individual, it used to be these, but if every person who has one of these, you share them, you digitize, you make them shared, that's our ICP. So there's a lot of power to that. And anyone can go to roomy.ai and try it yourself. If you have a big team and you'd like to experience this as a team, then we'll gladly, set up a pilot so you can see the power of, really shared note-taking instead of individual note-taking is our ICP.
We'll put those in the show notes. And I think the interesting thing, you just showed up that book you had just there. We've just finished moving and unpacked maybe four large cartons of those books, which we, my wife and I, over 25 years have had. And because there's probably a fair bit of confidential work inside each of those books, we've decided not to throw them out. But the amount, when you mentioned before that it's 10 feet high in terms of the number of notes that you would have, I believe it. Like there is just so much. And the advantage that a team has by having that recall is very, very substantial. Now, this is not something we plan to talk about, but if I can just put this to you, there is, I think, since COVID, an inherent fatigue that is built up in most organizations where I often say that we had, dog years added to our leadership lives through just having to learn how to operate throughout COVID, distributed teams, bigger pressures. We now have that next step up as well. And my theory is that the recall of leaders and teams just through fatigue alone has increased to a really substantial point. So the ability to focus more on things, the ability to pay very particular attention to the small details that make businesses work, I think is a little bit on the brink compared to where it used to be. And your tool set here, I think, plays a massive role in that recall. So from a perspective of your product, what do you think people can sort of genuinely expect if they were to start reusing Roomy today? And they then look back on it, they've been using it for 6 or 8 months, and they look back at a very functional level. How does the recall work in order for them to get, this is the decision we made 5 months ago, or for a new starter, probably even more importantly, how do I come up the curve of this company quickly so I can start adding value as a new team?
The best way to think about it is we are all probably using ChatGPT or something like that every single day. And we've gotten into the habit of that. And it's the exact value of that, except instead of asking what the internet knows, you're asking, what does my company know? And when you get used to that, it's unbelievable. Roomy knows more about my company than I do, way more, because it has listened to every single development, sales, internal discussion ever had. And as we bring on new team members, which we've done a lot of this year, when they're onboarding, instead of spending a lot of time in training, a lot of time them asking other colleagues for information, the first place they go is meeting memory. And they say, hey, are we GDPR compliant? Or what's our privacy policy? Or who is Sean in South Africa? And you get an answer. No, it's listened to, I don't even know how many hours of conversations. But when you have AI listening to, like you said, 6 months of conversations, there's almost no question it can't answer.
I find that mind-blowing for the simple reason that I think one of the greatest obsessions that I have as a CEO is hiring and onboarding and doing it as best as you possibly can. I can see how this would collapse the time to making that work because one of my engineering leaders once taught me that his job as an engineering leader, as our CTO, was to make sure that a new starter could commit code on their first day. That was his watermark for being organized and making sure that if we've got the right person, if we're organizing our own shop, that it might not be a lot of code, but he or she will be able to do that. And it always set a watermark for me for what we should be able to do to allow a person to not feel new except on their first day. And in doing so, I think tools like this take us a long way down the track of somebody feeling familiar and not having to wait 3 or 4 months to actually start contributing well, but to have the confidence to contribute, which I think is half the battle won anyway with something like meeting memories. It's a pretty significant advancement. I'm pretty impressed.
Yeah, we're really it's hard for us to imagine living without it at this point. Like, it is hard to imagine living without ChatGPT or something like that.
Right.
It's to that level. When we are in a meeting and it's not being recorded, obviously we don't record sensitive conversations, but
sure.
If I were in a meeting with you right now and I didn't have it, it feels like I showed up to the meeting without like a pen or, piece of paper. And I just hope I remember things. And
that's it.
Yeah, that's
it.
Not something we think about anymore.
I like that a lot. Listen, Ramsey, I've got one question to ask you before we get into our rapid fire today, and that is to do with something you're intimately familiar with. It's to do with the role of alliances and partnerships in any part of business. I think that this has become, my thesis at least, is that it has become mission critical to business success, short, medium, and long term. And a great number of people have entered into partnerships before under whatever title, an alliance, some kind of collaboration, and often they will not have worked out well, even though the promise was really substantial. So from your experience, not just at Roomie, but across the board, what do you think people are missing about the power of partnerships?
I think the biggest thing is just defining what that is really narrowly. I think when you say that word to someone, a certain type of partnership comes to mind. And that's probably their model of what partnership is. And so they have a very strong feeling about what types of partnerships make sense, what stage of their life cycle should they focus on it, how many should you have. In my experience, partnerships have been incredibly powerful at literally every stage, from pre-launch to very early stage to mid-stage. And then, when you're a gigantic company, partnerships are, what many people think about, like strategic alliances and things like that. But even an early stage startup, when I started BrightKey, partnerships were the vehicle that allowed us to get to the top of the app store. We would not have been able to do that without a partnership. And if you really think hard about what's in it for both parties, which I think is kind of the best definition of a partnership, where there's a lot of value for both parties in some way, then they can really help at every stage. And I've learned so many times that partnerships can drive more than 50% of all business. I've seen that at businesses of every size. So that's what comes to mind for me is what value could you give another company right now? What value could they give you? And you should probably be allocating a decent amount of bandwidth at all times to figuring that out.
Great answer. So let's get into the rapid fire. And look, thank you so much for the time today. We're going to link to Roomie in all the show notes and make sure that people have a good sense of what is happening in your shop. I think it's quite revolutionary. And it's made me rethink how the tools that we use here. So I'm very keen to have a look at it as well.
Thank you.
Let's dive in. Question one of this rapid fire round is, complete this sentence. Partnership is
a force multiplier at any stage, so long as there's value on both sides.
What content are you loving at the moment?
In real life. I think right now we're so inundated with content, and especially AI generated content, that in real life is the sexy thing again. And even for go-to-market, it's what's moving the needle and driving pipeline.
I love that. And you are the first person to say that. And I've asked that question 130 times. That is the first time. And I like it a lot. I'm gonna drive people more towards that in the future. What's the worst piece of advice you've received and why?
I don't think I have any. I think what I am realizing at this stage in my career is I've heard 10,000 pieces of advice, and maybe of all those, they're true at a certain time. but maybe there's a few at any point that come to mind all the time that I almost like write down and put on my desk because they're true to me in the moment. So yeah, I think any bit of advice could be good news, good advice or bad advice given where you are. So I try to figure out like, what's the cliche that I actually believe in right now and is going to help me.
Yeah. It's funny. Context really matters, right?
Mm-hmm.
All right. Question four, when you see potential for a new partnership, what's the first thing you do to turn that potential into action?
First thing I always do is map out what's in it for me, what's in it for them, and then see if that message lands.
Yeah. Yep. And it's funny for people who have not done business building before, that process that Ramsey's described can end up being 50 versions of a deck as you learn more and more about what it is that that person or that party needs. if you could look into the archive of most startups, I don't think you'd find less than 100 versions of go-to-market presentations that have all got little tweaks based on the small little thing that we heard in the next meeting that said, oh, actually, that makes sense. We should probably include that in the next conversation. So
very true.
I think we all know that that's living there somewhere. And look, Ramsey, last question. What's one thing you're deeply grateful for right now?
I'm deeply grateful for my network right now. At every chapter of my career, there are people who right now are helping me. And it's not always the person that you might have expected. But right now, I think, especially as an entrepreneur, your network is really your value. And those relationships are just so beneficial. So I'm grateful for those and trying to also be a good network connection for the people that I can help.
It's a great answer. Ramsey Prior, CEO at Roomy.ai. Thank you for making time today. It's been great spending time with you.
Thanks, Phil. It's been a pleasure.
Before you go, I have a quick question for you. Do you worry that you're wasting time, money, and credibility with the wrong partnerships? It's exhausting to pretend everything's fine while secretly worrying that you've made the wrong call. You see others thriving with the right connections, and you're stuck wondering if you're missing out on opportunities that could really elevate your business. Well, the good news is that ends today, because you can download my free partner calculator that instantly assesses if a partner is an ideal fit for your business. It'll give you the clarity and the confidence and the edge you've been looking for to secure high-value partnerships that not only finally unlock business growth, but also help you reclaim your time. The link is in the show notes. And I'm really glad you're here. I'm Coach Phil Hayes-Sinclair. I'll see you in the next episode.